Portraits. You could see his work all over town. The arched gold-leaf letters on the Citizens Bank window, the friendly blue script of Harling's clothing store, casting stenciled shadows on the yellowing shirts and fading dresses in the display window. The beauty spot, Becker's drug store, Dale's locker and freezer services, Thrifty Gas, almost every store in Shorter, Missouri, sported a unique hand-painted window sign, all done by the brush of Leo Hanna. He had painted a few in the downtown of the county seat of Cooperton, and the window of the sheriff's office one county over in Richfield. But Leo thought of downtown Shorter as being his gallery, and every business window his canvas. Every store and proprietor's name that he hand-lettered bore Leo's signature, a tiny palette with three brushes through the thumbhole, with his surname underneath, Hanna. The people of Shorter liked the idea that they had a town artist. Leo was a familiar sight in his white coveralls and cap, carrying a ladder and paint box down Pine Street to his work location, then back to his garage studio. Many businesses and homes had one of Leo's small watercolors or canvases on their walls, a farm scene or a landscape of the Missouri River bottom, sometimes something more romantic and far away, like a ship in a storm or a national monument, sometimes a portrait of a weathered farmer or a cowboy. Even when not wearing his work clothes, Leo liked to dress in white, often with a beret to match. Now that his hair and pencil mustache were becoming that same color, he cut a noticeable figure, getting double takes and side glances when he would go shopping in Cooperton. People a few towns over may not have known who he was, but they suspected he was somebody. While his height, coloring, and wardrobe made him conspicuous, his face had an expression of uneasy self-consciousness, like he didn't really want to be noticed, but something in his nature demanded otherwise. Leo rounded out his income doing on-sale signs for the grocery store, and occasionally, begrudgingly, doing exterior house painting. He would get offers to paint a living room or bedroom, but usually declined. Being in people's homes that long, that intimately, made him uncomfortable. Stories were whispered of Leo's trip to Paris when he was a young student, his short time in New York, and the rumors of arrest and heartbreak that had brought him back to his hometown. There were murmurs about his mother's quiet death and the artistic bachelor's life he kept. He wasn't quite like everyone else. He knew that. They knew that. And that was about all they knew. Most people assumed that somebody else in town knew Leo Hanna's story better than they did. But they were wrong. No one knew, because no one asked. They just guessed. The people of Shorter thought of him as Leo the sign painter, who had seen places they hadn't, who left town for a week now and then to go someplace unannounced, to meet up with someone unidentified, to do something unspecified. It was also whispered that Leo would sometimes make late-night visits to the home of Dolores Snow, the widow of Marvin Snow, who had been president of Citizens Bank. Dolores now managed the bank herself, and regularly and publicly made it known that she had no need for a man in her life. Was doing just fine, thank you. 4 years ago, Dolores had commissioned Leo to do a portrait of her late husband to hang in the bank. In discussion about the type of portrait, and searching through photos of Mr. Snow, Dolores had let Leo know that she didn't even like her husband, much less love him. The portrait was just to keep consistency, to keep loyal customers. That admission, that confidence, had seemed to open a connection of trust between them, a trust and an intimacy that Dolores made known early on must remain a secret. She had a second chance to build a life the way she saw fit, to have influence and power in the town and the county. Safeguard their money and people will dance like puppets, Dolores had told Leo. The sound of that statement giving him pause. Lend them money and they'll dance like strippers, Dolores upped the contempt in her voice. Leo believed that Dolores saw him as absolutely harmless, almost inconsequential. At times this seemed belittling to Leo. Other times, safe, contained, comfortable. He had a little money. He couldn't qualify for a loan. He was not particularly close to anyone. Leo was not mentioned in most people's daily conversations, and Dolores was not someone you openly gossiped about. For 4 years, this had worked for the both of them. They attended nothing together. They rarely spoke to one another in public. The occasional late-night phone call, the rare midnight visit, always according to Dolores' schedule. The townspeople saw him as Leo Hanna, the sign painter. He saw himself as just a painter, wanting to make pictures. Everything else was just noise and erasures and turpentine. It was late July now, and Whirlybird Day was coming up fast. It was a new experiment by the local merchants to bring people to the town, give them a good time, things to spend their money on. A helicopter would be piloted in from Kansas City, would give rides and drop prizes and such. That's all Leo knew about the event, other than he'd been asked to do quick charcoal portraits at the street fair. In the previous decade, the local merchants had tried hard to establish the Shorter Butterfly Festival. The town of Shorter was on the migration path of the monarch butterfly. Sometimes. The mayor and the merchants started the annual butterfly festival, hoping that the fragile orange and black cloud would pass through, and hopefully sometime close to the first weekend of August when the festival was held. In the decade of the festival's existence, the weekend timing had only worked out once, and the migration had actually passed through Shorter only 4 times in its recorded history. The town would hoist a banner over the state highway, announcing Butterfly Capital of Missouri. Stores would decorate their windows with paper cutouts, surrounding Leo's lettering in a fanciful halo of wings. But the Butterfly Festival was eventually canceled and given up, when visitors were constantly disappointed by the lack of butterflies. People wrote nasty letters to the Republican follower, talking about what a fraud it was, and they wanted their money back, even though admission was free. Leo had made arrangements with Rita McAfee, chairperson of the festival, to do charcoal portraits at the craft fair, something he only did when he absolutely had to. Presently, he was in need of money. Only one new business in town this year, a couple other windows over in Cooperton, a few exterior jobs. It had been a lean year. During his college days, Leo had often done charcoal portraits at fairs and festivals to help with tuition and expenses. He stopped doing it for several decades, but now was doing portraits more often, at school carnivals, church picnics, and such, as his sign painting business had dropped off. But he wasn't happy about it. While he didn't doubt his ability, he dreaded the frustrations of trying to draw a person in a less-than-studio situation. It would be hot, it would be noisy, people would be looking over his shoulder, much of it would be wiggling kids whose parents wanted a cute picture. Then there was the fact that most people really had no idea what they actually looked like. Leo had encountered outraged women who demanded he erase the nose and make it smaller. Cranky couples who wondered why he didn't draw them smiling. Farmers who paid and sat, but thought it was a lot of nonsense. But possibly the hardest part was, once Leo put pencil to paper, he cared about it a little too much. He was not a cartoonist or a caricaturist. He couldn't place people on tiny horses or motorcycles. He couldn't deliberately make their ears big, or their eyes bulging, or their smile crooked to get a laugh. He needed to draw what he saw. Once the person sat still, and Leo was given the permission to intently stare at every detail of their face, to look into their eyes without questions or conversation, to lean in close in a way that would be awkward or unnerving in any other situation, then Leo was lost. Lost in that wordless tumble, out of himself and into the space that this other person occupied. He needed to know what it felt like in that space. Their stories and experiences didn't really matter. It was just their being. Being here, being there. He could get the smallest glimpse of understanding by drawing those lines that made up their face, the shading under their chin, the way their hairline met their forehead, the glinting spark of wet life reflecting in their eyes. There was never enough time. The farmer would lose patience and get fidgety. The woman would suddenly feel overly self-conscious of Leo's gaze and need to talk and gesture. And the kids, well, the kids would just leave. Leo had finished many a portrait from the fresh memory of hair and neck and collar. The day arrived. The festival started at 10, a patriotic kickoff with a veteran's color guard and the Pledge of Allegiance. Leo left home and walked up Pine Street to the center crossroads of town, traffic blocked off and detoured so all the vendors could set up in the street. He carried his H-shaped folding drawing stool, his large clipboard, toolbox, thermos jug of water, and a roll of light gray charcoal paper. He had learned long ago that it was a great waste of time to offer people a choice of different colored paper. Gray, that was it. As he walked past Rita McAfee, she spoke to him to tell him where he was to set up. But he didn't seem to hear her, and Rita McAfee thought she might have smelled alcohol as Leo passed. She made a mental note to check on him later, and regularly, to make sure he was not sneaking drinks while he drew, being around children and all.
Leo, where do you think you're going? I mean, where do you think you're going?
Oh, Rita, I guess I don't really know. I mean, I hadn't thought it out.
There's nothing to think out,
Rita McAfee said sharply, like she was talking to a daydreaming child. Rita was a fourth grade teacher, and Leo figured she just didn't know any other way to talk.
Your space is just to the right of the bank door, starting at the curb, Rita said. You have 42 square feet, 7x6. It's marked in chalk.
Rita pointed, jabbing her finger repeatedly in the air like Leo might not know where the bank was located. Just behind Rita McAfee was a small group of women, including Dolores Snow, the bank president. The other women stared as Rita McAfee barked her orders to Leo. But Dolores Snow seemed to see something of interest in the opposite direction. Leo wasn't sure if her diversion was intentional. Also wasn't sure if he imagined a look of passing pity from the other women in the group. He walked to the sidewalk in front of the bank, to the right of the door and past the curb. Squinting, he saw some smudged and disappearing blue chalk marks on the asphalt. At the moment, his square was in the shade, but he knew it would not be for the entire afternoon, so he set up his drawing stool on the north edge of the chalk lines to stay in the shade as long as possible. Leo didn't know who or how many portraits he might be drawing today. Interested people had to purchase tickets at the main ticket booth, $10 for a portrait, and put their names on a schedule there, making a guess at a best half hour to stop by Leo's booth. Rita McAfee was to periodically bring Leo a list of upcoming names and times. Leo's plan was to schedule portraits on the half hour, work nonstop from 11 a.m. until 7 p.m. 16 portraits in 8 hours, $160 if he could fill all the slots. If he could finish each one in 20 or 25 minutes, then he would have a few minutes between sitters to grab something to eat and drink, find the porta potty. He could do this, and luckily the festival did not take part of his earnings. They were glad for artists and merchants to bring activities that would draw more people to the downtown area. They were making plenty of money at the beer garden anyway. Around him, other booths were already set up and doing business, selling needlepoint, things made out of driftwood, racks of turquoise jewelry, clocks mounted on old hubcaps. The clacking of the kiddie rides and the accompanying metallic nursery rhyme music mixed in the air with the smells of corn dogs and funnel cakes and portable toilets. The festival had begun, and Leo needed to get focused and get to work. Rita McAfee brought him a short list of the first portrait appointments. He hoped the list would fill up.
Could you bring me a folding chair?
Leo asked Rita.
Why didn't you bring one yourself?
Rita was scolding already.
Well,
and Leo opened his hands, gesturing at all the things he had carried from his house. Rita was back a minute later with a folding chair.
Here we go,
Leo said to himself. His first sitter was a boy of about 10,
Someone had actually slicked down his hair and made him wear a nice shirt, like he was getting a school picture taken. Leo thought he knew this boy, or at least knew his family. Rita had just written Weber on the schedule. Leo thought this was Phil Weber. Was that right, Phil? Or was that his older brother?
Are you Phil?
Leo asked him.
Who?
The boy seemed confused.
Is your name Phil Weber?
No, I don't know who that is,
said the boy.
Don't make me look like him.
Great. Things were already getting out of order. The boy was obviously uneasy now, getting restless. Leo had never been good at putting people at ease, particularly kids. They always seemed so foreign to him, so from another time. He always felt like he was talking to someone from the future. He couldn't understand what their life and their world looked like, just as they couldn't possibly understand his. Like a caveman talking to a space traveler. Stop. Get focused. Draw. Make some money.
Sorry, my mistake. I promise I won't make you look like Phil Weber. Why don't you just look right over there at the Ferris wheel and just start counting the cars?
1, 2, 3, jet,
said the boy.
What? And don't count out loud.
That's my name, Jet. Jet Van Meter, 16.
You can't be 16.
No, that's how many cars are on the Ferris wheel,
said Jet Van Meter. Leo felt like he was listening to a foreign language. He couldn't figure out where this conversation was going, but he knew they needed to stop talking if he was going to stay on schedule.
Well, Jet, just look over at the Ferris wheel. Keep your eyes on it. See if it starts moving. Count the metal pieces that make up the wheel. Count how many triangles are on the side. Just keep looking at it and try not to talk.
Leo quickly laid in 3 horizontal lines where Jet's eyes, nose, and mouth would be. A quick loop for his hairline and top of his head, and a short one marked the bottom of his chin. A question mark that formed Jet's visible ear and jawline. Really, that was most of what Leo needed. Faces were all different, but they were basically the same. It was the distances, the small difference of space between features that made someone look, well, like themselves. As Jet looked away, Leo leaned in. He could see, he could feel the short distances between the boy's small features. The space Jet Van Meter took up now was so much less than it would be in a few years, when his nose would bulb outward, his eyebrows form a cliff and a cave to hide his eyes, when he would feel his limbs reach, almost detached from his small safe center. Leo could sense the compact simplicity of being Jet Van Meter. Nothing reaching out, nothing reaching in. Curiosity was a window that showed you a Ferris wheel. Leo tumbled into that small space and could see, could feel the boy's young skin. Draw nothing, no texture, no wrinkles, no blemishes. That's all it required. The less he drew, the more it would look like Jet Van Meter. Leo's freshly sharpened charcoal pencil drew light, crisp lines to form Jet's eyes, nostrils, lips. The only firmly dark areas were the pupils of his eyes, with a carefully avoided spot just off center of each pupil. There was a moment. There was always a moment. This moment. Leo picked up the white Conte crayon and touched it firmly to the spot on the drawing that was on the pupil of Jet Van Meter's eye. A bright, white dot. The light of life, its warm, wet reflection. At that moment, 4 images flashed in Leo's mind. A coin, a hand on a puppy, the frayed hem of a woman's flowered dress, a glass of milk. Leo closed his eyes and the images printed on his memory. He had no idea what they meant. He didn't really want to know. The boy's eyes suddenly darted, made contact with Leo's gaze. He flinched and frowned just slightly.
I gotta go,
Jet Van Meter said.
My mom will come and get it.
And he left. Leo looked down at the drawing, consciously slowed his breathing, checked his wristwatch.
He'd only spent 10 minutes on the portrait and was pretty close to finished. He closed his eyes, recovering the image of Jet's face, and continued added shading and highlights and just a bit of warm color around the cheeks. Standing up from his drawing stool, Leo turned his back on the sketch, took 2 steps away, paused, then turned quickly to see the portrait in a glimpse. This was ritual. This was process. He always did it. He needed to have some idea of what it would look like to the people who took it home. Returning to the stool, a few more lines in the hair, a bit darker under the chin, then his signature, the 3 brushes, and he was done. He gave the drawing a light coat of spray fixative to keep it from smudging. But there was one final step to the process, the last move of the ritual. Leo reached into his toolbox and brought out his Polaroid camera. He aimed carefully and took a photograph of the finished drawing, because he would never see it again, and part of it belonged to him. Really, he felt it completely belonged to him, but he was sending it away. He unclipped the drawing from the board, carefully rolled it up and rubber banded it. He looked around for somebody that looked like they might be Jet Van Meter's mother, then stowed the drawing behind the toolbox. He tried hard to avoid the thought that it would possibly, likely, get crinkled, bent, folded, crushed, ending up in a box or wastebasket. Leo took a cold drink of water from his thermos, stretched his back, and checked the schedule for his next sitter. He knew this name, knew it very well. Forrest Lunville was a farmer, exactly Leo's age. Exactly. Leo knew this because they had been classmates in early grade school, before Forrest was held back a year. They shared the same birthday, born in the same hospital, exactly the same age. Leo saw Forrest approaching his booth and waved him on over.
How you doing, old pal, and happy belated birthday to you.
Forrest always said the same thing when he saw Leo.
I always wanted to get one of them paintings of yours. I figured it might as well be something I like.
Forrest laughed. He was always laughing.
Well, this will be a charcoal sketch, not a painting.
Same thing,
Forrest said. As they got seated and worked past those first discomforts, Leo asked,
Would you mind taking off your cap?
I don't look like myself without my AC cap on,
Forrest said with a nervous chuckle.
Actually, you kind of look just like everybody else with your cap on.
Leo hoped that didn't come out wrong. Forrest took off his cap, which bore the red and black logo of Alice Chalmers. He pushed his thinning hair back in one move, flattened it with his palm. Leo leaned forward. He could immediately see the boy he had known in kindergarten, first and second grade. He was still there, barely below the weathered surface. As Leo leaned forward, so did Forrest, like that was what he was supposed to do.
Just sit back in the chair, try to relax. Watch the Ferris wheel.
Is it okay if I talk?
Let's talk later. Yeah, we'll talk later.
Ha! That's hard for me, but I'll give her a go.
The 3 face lines, the loop of the head, the mark of the chin and the shoulders, and Leo was off. And in. Forrest's eyes kept darting over to Leo, then back to the middle distance, but Leo ignored it. Even on this clean-scrubbed Saturday, Leo could sense the soil, the earth that had become part and whole of who Forrest was. Sun-baked creases wrapped his neck, plowed fields waiting for rain. His pale scalp, through his graying hair, covered all the dreads that the season might bring. His large ears held echoes of the hot country wind and the blizzard, smile lines, but hard planting in the corners of his mouth. Leo defined the eyes, blacked the pupils, sparked the white crayon, saw an image of a teenage girl, then a field on fire, then a radio. He thought he heard Forrest sigh, but wasn't sure. Then it was done. After the fixing and the Polaroid, Leo held the drawing up for Forrest to see. It was quick, hard to read, but Leo saw it in Forrest's face. The stop, the pause, the wonder at himself.
Well, maybe I can give it to somebody to use for a dartboard or maybe to scare away birds.
Forrest was back to laughing.
No, really, Leo, it's real nice, real nice. I do thank you.
He paused.
We've known each other a long time, haven't we?
Even though they only saw each other occasionally, rarely spoke, Leo answered,
Yes, yes, we have. And we'll always have that first birthday party to remember. Or not,
Leo said to break the awkward moment. He had seen Forrest, looked at him clearly and kindly without judgment, left a record of it as proof that someone had indeed seen him. Three other sittings followed. A young schoolteacher from Cooperton that he didn't know, a Miss Ellen Hartkins. She was calm and not at all self-conscious, a plain and easy-to-miss beauty in her features. Her eyes were narrow-set, and the spark gave Leo images of a lighthouse, a piano, and Franklin Roosevelt. Then Hank Harling, who owned the clothing store, with a single image of a basketball. Then an 8-year-old girl, Vanita Petrus, from whom Leo got no pictures at all. As he was putting the final touches on Vanita's portrait, she had skedaddled a while ago, Rita McAfee came up from behind him, talking to him as he worked.
Leo, they're going to do that ball drop thing in about 20 minutes, you know, where they drop all those ping pong balls from the helicopter so people can win prizes.
Rita McAfee leaned unnecessarily close to Leo. Was she smelling him? Leo hadn't heard about this helicopter ping pong balls thing, or maybe he had, but he didn't register the details. He looked around, just now noticing how crowded the central intersection had become.
Really? Where?
Yes, really. And right here, right over your dang head. So you probably should, I don't know, fold it up for a while, put your stuff away. I think it's going to get crazy down here for a bit.
Great, Leo thought. He had counted on working straight through, just as long as he could, make as many portraits and as much money as possible.
Okay, I just need to finish this one up and find Jet Van Meter's mother. Do you know her?
But Rita was already walking away. Leo continued working on Vanita's portrait, looking around as he did, noticing how crowded it was getting under the four-way stop. People were crossing and crowding inside his chalk line, and he moved the metal folding chair to his right side to keep people from bumping his arm as they passed. He saw that it was getting crowded, really crowded, and began gathering his things, not bothering to get a Polaroid of Vanita's portrait before he rolled it up. Leo was on his knees, hurrying to put the spray fixative, the pencils and erasers into the toolbox. A man and woman wearing matching orange t-shirts came charging through his area, his chalk square, tripping over Leo and landing in a tangle on top of his roll of gray charcoal paper. Leo felt the pavement under him grow wet and realized the woman, or maybe the man, had spilled a large beer on the roll of gray paper into the toolbox, and now it was soaking into the seat of Leo's white pants.
For fuck's sake, get out of the way! The chopper's coming!
The man shouted at Leo.
Oh, it's you,
the woman said, stretching out the last word. Leo had no idea who she was, didn't think he'd ever seen her before. The woman helped the man up, and they elbowed off into the crowd, taking the empty cup with them, but leaving a flip-flop behind. Leo sat stunned in the puddle of beer for a moment, then realized more people were closing in on him and he needed to move fast or risk being trampled. Pouring what beer he could out of the toolbox, he grabbed up the now soggy, ruined roll of charcoal paper, the stool, the drawing board, the thermos. The two unclaimed drawings were surprisingly dry and not crumpled. Leo started a panicky shuffle through the crowd, roughly shouldering people out of his way, swinging his folded stool into shins. He used the large drawing board like a blade to force his way through ungiving walls of backs and shoulders and chests. He saw faces he knew and faces he didn't know, but he wasn't conscious of any difference between them. Faces were gray. Clothing was gray. It looked like dusk in Leo's field of vision. Children looked at him and knew to get out of the way. He was clenching and gritting his teeth, angry and frustrated, and also afraid and shaken. He had so needed this money, this income, but the idea of a successful day had made him ignore the fact and not admit to himself that he was nearly broke. And now he felt it, felt it from the bones out, and the panic and rage caught him by surprise. Cutting through a few more waves of people who were charging the center square, Leo was finally two blocks away from the crowd, slowing down the farther he walked. He sat down on the curb. There were still people on the sidewalk across the street, but they paid no attention to him. They were looking up into the sky. He started to follow their gaze up over the trees toward the grade school, but then dropped his head to his chest. He just didn't care. He looked at the roll of paper, now torn and damp, stained and wrecked. This could have been so many good pictures, he thought. This could have been... But he ran out of words. He angrily wadded the paper into a pulpy ball and pitched it over his shoulder with both hands, and it landed in the yard of the school superintendent. Leo flailed his arms like he was swatting away bees, then heaved the toolbox out into the middle of the street where it burst open. Pencils and erasers scattered, several snapshots flipped away in the breeze, a new one emitted from the camera. Leo could hear a roar and shouting and cheers from the center of town. Across the street, a woman with a preteen boy, a toddler, and one in a stroller were staring at him.
You okay?
The boy called to Leo.
That's what happens when you drink,
the mother said.
Like your Grandpa Willard. Come on, stop looking.
They walked away. Leo took off his beret and wiped his forehead with it. He shook his head. And again. His pencils, his erasers. He felt like he owed them an apology. They were friends, his dear and intimate friends. Treated so. Who was he? What had happened? Pulling his spraying thoughts back into his head, back into some kind of order, Leo wheeled himself up off the curb. He stood in the middle of the street and surveyed his humble and scattered but treasured possessions. His tools, his joys. He was embarrassed, but only to himself. He honestly didn't care if anyone saw him. This moment of embarrassment was only a fuse, only a crumb trail that led into all the other forests and caves and flammables of embarrassment that, on a better day, he could usually avoid. He began picking up his supplies, chasing down the Polaroid photos that had blown across the street, even the random one that the camera had emitted upon impact. It was a beautiful square of the purest blue. Leo's small house was only another three blocks south on Roundway Street. Small, yes, it was. No mortgage, paid for, yes, it was. He squinted as he approached in the afternoon sun, almost able to see it as it had looked when he was a child. He had inherited the house cleanly when his mother died, but now it needed so many repairs. Needed a new roof, needed new plumbing and wiring. Many of the windows wouldn't open. Many of the doors wouldn't close. The front porch, where he had played and sketched and read as a child, was now paint-bare, gray, bleached wood. The porch swing was still there, but he wouldn't dare sit in it. The house and his 12-year-old Dodge were the only things Leo owned, and it was still too much. How does one free themselves from the burden of possessions and still have a place to live and a way to get around? Even now, at this moment, that seemed like the essential, yet stupidest question. Entering, the front living room was hot and uncomfortable now, and would be for hours into the night. In the back of the house, the bedroom was a bit cooler, being in the shade of the sycamore tree. Before sitting on the bed, Leo unbuttoned his pants, still wet in the seat, and let them drop to the floor. He kicked them into the corner, his shoes with them, then his sweat-damp shirt. He lay down on the bedspread, then pulled it back to get to the cool sheets beneath. Fuck this. He didn't know what this was or where he would go after it was fucked, but still, fuck this. Before he could even get his mind around the idea that he was tired, he fell asleep. Strange, hot afternoon dreams. Dreams of faces, so many faces. He kept looking for the right one, but they were going by too fast. He didn't know who he was looking for, but thought he would know the face when he saw it. But it was dim light in the dream, hard to make out features. Then he was awake. Time. He had no idea. No idea if he'd been asleep 10 minutes or 2 hours. Leo pulled himself up, groggily awake, shaky on his feet. He wandered into the kitchen, opened the back door to let some air in. On the other side of the screen door, fist raised in an interrupted knock, was Dolores Snow. Dolores of the bank, Dolores of the late-night phone calls. And here he stood in his briefs.
Give me a second,
Leo said. Dolores opened the screen door, uninvited, and stepped into the kitchen. It flashed on Leo that she didn't want to stand out there any longer than necessary, didn't want anyone to see her. She had never come to his house before. Leo felt a kind of surprise that she even knew where he lived. But of course, she knew where he lived.
Just a second,
Leo said again. He backed around the corner into the bedroom, reaching into his dark closet. Not looking, he came out with an old kimono that had belonged to his mother, but he had kept for some reason. Too short in the sleeves, way too short in the rear, but he put it on without thinking. The red and black satin patterns, the green dragon, were as out of place as Dolores.
I'll be right back,
Leo called, and went into the bathroom. Dolores walked on into the living room.
I always wondered what this place looked like, she thought.
It was pretty much as she had expected. Still and stale, not cluttered, a bit dusty, with just a touch of old lady to how things were arranged. Across the living room was a door, to another bedroom, Dolores assumed. Opening it, peeking in, she couldn't quite understand what she was seeing. A grid of small white frames, small squares of gray and color, covering the entire north wall, almost floor to ceiling, and wrapped around the corner onto the adjacent west wall. For one moment of horror, she thought they were photographs of young boys and girls. But stepping in, looking closer, she saw tens, dozens, maybe a couple hundred faces, Polaroids of portraits that Leo had drawn and painted over the years. Among the faces were a few pictures of farms and forests, like windows in a crowded auditorium. Almost all the faces were turned three-quarters to the left, giving the impression that something of interest was happening across the room and behind her. She saw people she knew and people she didn't know. She saw faces that were much older now. She saw her dead husband. She quietly backed out of the room and closed the door. Dolores walked back into the kitchen, and there stood Leo wearing, what, some kind of ornamental robe? This raised in her mind one of the questions she always had about Leo. Was he artful and unique, or just oblivious?
Well, now, there's a man of the world, she said.
What are you doing here, Dolores?
Oh, I had to get out of that mess downtown. People were killing each other for those damn ping-pong balls. Some asshole fell against the door of the bank and cracked the glass. I swear, I don't know whose idea it was for this whole helicopter whirlybird thing, but I wish I had squashed it early on.
You could do that?
Leo asked. But Dolores didn't answer. She didn't need to.
Actually, Rita asked me if I could find you. She said you're supposed to be down there doing portraits, but that you disappeared on her. She was pretty mad.
She's always mad, near as I can tell, Leo said.
I would be too, if I had her job. I think she's going to retire next year. She should have retired last year.
Well, I won't be going back down for the portraits, Leo said. All my paper got ruined, I got trampled, and I wasn't really enjoying it.
He didn't mention his need for the income to Dolores. He consciously left out any mentions of money, business, debts from his conversations with Dolores.
I'd avoid Rita for a few days if I were you. She bears a grudge. And dang, that's too bad. I always got the idea you enjoyed doing the portraits.
She thought about all the faces in the bedroom, but decided not to say anything about seeing them.
I enjoy parts of it. Most of it,
Leo said.
but it was getting too hot and too crowded down there. People were bumping into me.
Well, then, I guess you owe me $10 because I put my name on the list and paid for a portrait. I was going to surprise you. I thought it would make you nervous if I told you in advance.
Dolores paused.
I guess if you're not going back down there, and I really don't want to go back down there, well, I guess you could draw me now. You've got to have some kind of paper around here, don't you?
No, I really don't. All out. All ruined.
The sun through the kitchen window, diffused by the old screen, was lighting Dolores' face. Just so. Leo could see the time of day, the years in Dolores' face, see the moment and the timelessness behind it.
Stay right there, right where you are,
Leo told her. He went to the kitchen sink, knelt down to the doors beneath, pulled out a brown paper grocery sack, and cut an even square out of the smooth, unprinted side.
This is all I have. It'll have to do. Brown, that's the only choice of paper today.
Can I sit?
Asked Dolores.
No, you can't, and neither can I.
Leo retrieved his toolbox from the bedroom and a cookie sheet from beside the oven to use as a drawing board. He quickly drew the lines and loops of Dolores's face. The delicate point of his charcoal pencil carefully defined her lips, nostrils, and eyes. His thumb smudged roundness and dimension into the drawing, capturing the gentle touch of the afternoon light. He was caressing her on the paper in a way he was hesitant to do in reality.
We can sit now, Leo said. I'm almost finished.
Leo picked up his toolbox, and they moved into the living room, Dolores to the couch, Leo to the chair opposite her, where he continued to make small adjustments to the features and the fall of the light. He glanced up at Dolores from time to time as he drew. She would be staring at him, at his progress, then quickly look away when he raised his eyes. Leo sighed and ran his fingers through his white hair, surprised to find he still had on his beret. It fell to the floor behind his chair. He reached for the white crayon and brought it to the eyes of the drawing, but stopped before touching it to the paper. He dropped the crayon back into the metal box with a small clink and reached for the fixative.
That's it. That's the best I can do.
These were thoughts, not words.